World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Lee Modison Jr. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and I started this podcast because I, too, write science fiction and fantasy, and I enjoy talking to other authors of those genres about how they go about the same thing that I try to do effectively all the time. My latest book is my ninth novel for New York Staw Books. It's called World Shaper. Set in a world that seems very much like ours. The main character is a young woman named Shauna Keys, who's just opened a pottery studio in a small Montana city. And then she discovers that things are not what they seem. A mysterious stranger shows up, and while she's trying to figure out what he's all about, there's a terrible attack on her favorite coffee shop, and her friend is killed, and she can't believe it's happening, and when she says that out loud, this isn't happening, all of a sudden, it's not happening. It turns out that, in fact, she shaped this world. She is kind of like the authors I talk to on this podcast, only she lives inside the world that she has created, and she has no memory of creating it. The mysterious stranger then explains to her that this is just one of many shaped worlds in a vast labyrinth of shaped worlds, and that it has now been invaded by an adversary, the one who killed her friend and tried to kill her, and that he now has control of this world because he managed to steal from her the knowledge of its shaping, and she has to flee it, or he will kill her. And the mysterious stranger, whose name is Carl, also tells her that he believes that she has the power to save all the shaped worlds if she can visit as many of them as she can, gather their knowledge, the knowledge of their shapers, into herself, and deliver it to the mysterious Agrare, who's the woman at the center of this vast labyrinth. That's the premise. The first book received a starred review from Publishers Weekly, and a good review from Booklist, and other good reviews. It has a lot of humor in it. It may sound a little grim, but it has a lot of humor in it. I'm currently working on the second book, which is called A Master of the World, and that will be out in September of 2019. Now, I'm actually doing a giveaway for an autographed copy of World Shaper. All you have to do is send me an email at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T, at gmail.com. Put something in the subject line about this being for the World Shaper giveaway, and I will enter you in a draw, and I'll be giving away that at the start of the new year, so only bother with the entry if you're hearing this before January 1st, 2019. Okay, that's the obligatory self-promotion bit of the podcast, and now we will get on to why you are really here, which is to listen to my conversation with Lee Modisett Jr. Lee Modisett Jr. is the best-selling author of more than 70 novels, encompassing two science fiction series and four fantasy series, as well as several other science fiction novels. Mr. Modisett has been a Mr. Modisett. That's what it says in the bio. I can call you Lee, I hope.
Absolutely.
Okay. Lee has been a delivery boy, a lifeguard, an unpaid radio disc jockey, deep breath, a U.S. Navy pilot, a market research analyst, a real estate agent, a director of research for a political campaign, a legislative assistant and staff director for a U.S. congressman, director of legislation and congressional relations for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, a consultant on environmental regulatory and communications issues, and a college lecturer and writer-in-residence. In addition to his novels, Lee has published technical studies and articles, columns, poetry, and a number of science fiction short stories. His first story was published in 1973. We'll find out about that in the course of the interview. And he lives in Cedar City, Utah. And something I discovered while looking into you for the podcast was that your wife is an opera singer. I didn't know that.
Yes, she is, and she runs the voice and opera program at Southern Utah University.
Well, having done a modicum of opera singing myself and a great deal more musical theater, that caught my eye. So, well, welcome to the World Shapers.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, I think you're yet another, I seem to say this a lot, I think you're another author that I am interviewing on here whom I first met at a science fiction convention in Calgary. I think that's where we first met, at Conversion, which doesn't really exist anymore.
And then that's exactly where it was.
It was there. We run into each other mostly at Worldcon since then, I guess. So that's where I asked you if you'd be on the podcast, was at the last World Science Fiction Convention. So again, thanks for that.
Well, you're welcome.
Now, I'd asked you which novel you would like to focus on, and you said you would like to talk about your science fiction novel, Haze, which I just finished reading, so I'm all set for that. But we'll talk about that a little bit later as we get into your creative process. But first, I'd like to get some more detail on how guests got started in the field, how they started writing. So if we go way back into time, how did you start writing fiction, and how did your interest in science fiction and fantasy develop? Was this a childhood thing, or did it come along later?
Actually, all right, I always was interested in science fiction and fantasy. I started reading it at a very young age, and actually my mother was the one who introduced me to it. My father was an attorney, and he didn't have much interest in that sort of sky blue stuff that just wasn't hard and fast, whereas my mother was much more of a speculative mindset. And we lived in what was then the countryside, so to speak, and we weren't close to libraries and we weren't close to stores, but she did have this gray painted bookcase in the front of her bedroom, and it was filled with paperback science fiction novels. And seeing as there was nothing else much interesting to read, I wasn't going to read my father's law books. I started reading science fiction. But I never really thought I was going to write it. As a matter of fact, I was going to be the next William Butler Yeats, because my interest initially was in poetry. I read poetry, wrote it, did projects on it, essentially had a minor in it in college, although it wasn't called that because they didn't offer that minor. But I actually spent 2 years studying under William J. Smith, who was the poet who then later became the poet laureate of the, or the poet for the Congressional Reference Service in Washington, D.C., and that position then became the poet laureate of the United States. So I was a, and I wrote poetry for some 15 years before I even thought of writing science fiction. As a matter of fact, I was turned down with form rejections from the Yale Younger Poet Contest every year until I was too old to be a younger poet. Then I was in my late 20s, and my first ex-wife basically suggested that maybe I should try something besides poetry. And she suggested science fiction since I wrote it. I mean, since I read it. And so I thought, I can try that. And I wrote a short story, and I sent it off to Ben Bova, who was, had just taken over as the editor of Analog. And he sent back a rejection. And the rejection letter said, "This isn't half bad, but you made a terrible mess out of page 13. It's good enough that if you can fix it, I'll look at it again." I did, and he bought it. He bought it.
What was the name of it?
The Great American Economy. Well, I mean, I was an economist by training, and it seemed like a good place to go. It took me something like somewhere in the neighborhood of another 26 stories before I could sell the second one. And it was maybe 17 or 18 before I sold the third one. And this went on for maybe, I guess, 5-6 years. And then Ben sent me another rejection letter. And it began with the words, "Don't send me any more stories. I won't buy them." And after I got over the shock of those, I looked at the next paragraph, which said, "It's clear that you are a novelist trying to cram novels into short stories. Go write a novel. After that, we'll talk about stories." Now, I hadn't wanted to write a novel. At the time, I was working as a legislative director for a U.S. congressman in Washington. Long hours. And I didn't want to write 500,000 words to sell 90,000. But Ben didn't give me any choice. So I wrote a novel. And it sold, and that's another story, but it did sell, and every novel I've ever written since then has sold. So Ben was absolutely right about the fact that I was probably a better novelist than a short story writer.
Well, when you were writing poetry, how young were you when you started writing poetry?
I started getting published when I was about 15, only in small literary magazines.
There's not a lot of other market for poetry except small literary magazines anymore, is there?
Well, there is. I mean, you can theoretically publish it in the New York or the Atlantic Monthly and a few other places like that, but that's about it.
I was going to say, was your poetry, did it show any elements of the fantastical in your poetry?
Oh, I think one or two maybe had a few hints of the fantastical in it. I did do one poem, as I recall, about Atlantis, so I guess that had a certain fantastical element in it, but most of them weren't.
Do you still write poetry?
Oh, yes. And I've incorporated it into a lot of my novels. I mean, there are two novels in the Recluse series that are literally linked together by a book of poetry. And the resolution of the second novel is partly shaped by that poetry and the existence of that poetry.
What part of the country did you grow up in? You live in Cedar City, Utah now. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the suburbs south of Denver, Colorado. When I was very young, my father decided he wanted to practice law in Hawaii, so we moved to Honolulu, and we lived there for a year and a half. He decided it wasn't the best place to practice law or raise children, so we moved back to Denver, and we lived there until I went away to college.
And where did you go to university?
I went to Williams College in Massachusetts.
And you said you studied economics?
I had economics and political science, a double major.
That sounds like the sort of thing that would help you with the creation of societies in science fiction and fantasy. Is that true?
Oh, I think it helped. It helped a great deal. Plus, 20 years or 18 years in the national political arena certainly didn't hurt any. And I had a couple of years as an industrial market researcher, which was basically an economic, and it was probably the most boring job one can possibly imagine, because my job was to forecast the sales patterns of compressed air, filters, regulators, lubricators, and valves. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds utterly fascinating. Have you ever gotten a story out of that?
I never could make a story out of that one. I've made stories out of a few other jobs I had, but not that one.
You were also in the U.S. Navy for a few years and were a pilot. What kind of aircraft did you fly?
Actually, I started out as an amphibious officer, and I hated small boats so much. In the middle of the Vietnam War, I volunteered for flight training. And the Navy decided I was a decent pilot, but not a great pilot, so I ended up flying helicopters and was a search and rescue pilot.
Do you think that military experience has, for example, in Hayes, the character is a military man of sorts.
Yes.
Does your military experience play into your writing as well, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've written a number. I mean, I'm not certainly extensively a writer of military science fiction, but I've probably written at least And the military does fit into an awful lot of my books in one way or another. I won't say maybe 40%. That's just a guess. But yeah, it's been a big factor.
I seem to remember at the aforementioned conversion in Calgary that you talked about economic systems in fantasy and science fiction and how there's a lot of unworkable ideas of how societies might work, and certainly in Hayes, which again we're going to talk to about detail in a little bit, but there's a lot of speculation about the ways that societies work. Is that something you like to bring into your fiction, is trying to create a more realistic society in that respect?
That's exactly how I got into writing fantasy. I wrote science fiction, strictly science fiction, for almost the first 20 years I was writing. I got into writing fantasy because I got really tired of all of these fantasies where people go off on quests with no visible means of support, or they're 10,000 armed knights on a side. One of the things that it dawned on me in terms of writing fantasy is almost never, especially in early year, the fantasy when I was first, that was being published when I first started writing, did anybody have a real job? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've done in all of my fantasies, and which is still very rare, all of my characters in fantasies have real jobs. They have to make a living. And the magic system has to be monetized. This is still very rare. A lot of people basically have a character, he's got a real job, but he's on vacation or the job gets lost, and they just go off with the fantasy stuff. When I'm writing fantasy, the economics and the magic are all integral. And one of the reasons for this is, maybe it's because I was trained as an economist, maybe because I've been in politics, but I realized something about, call it technology, and that is, we don't hang on to technology. We don't use it unless it's good for one of two things. It's either a tool that will make somebody money or it will entertain somebody. You think about it. Well, magic would be the same way. If magic were real, nobody'd bother with it unless they could do something with it, make money out of it, or if they could entertain people. Because we as a species are tool users. We are pretty much pragmatic, but we like to be entertained. So if magic can't do one of those two things, it's not really going to be terribly useful in a society. And that's probably too much of the soapbox, but anyway, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I was just thinking about fantasies I've read. It seems like there's a preponderance of people are like thieves, bards, or mercenaries, and that seems to be like the three going job opportunities in a lot of fantasy worlds.
Well, I think part of that is because people don't think through what fantasy and magic can be used for. I do think that in my fantasies, I come up with, shall we say, practical and both ingenious ways of using magic, because people would.
Now, what distinguishes science fiction and fantasy for you? You write both. What's the difference between them for you as a writer? I interviewed Orson Scott Card, and he famously said that, you know, fantasy has trees and science fiction has rivets.
Well, I've been accused of writing fantasy with rivets, so I'm not sure I agree with that one. But my feeling is it's simply the ground rules. Science fiction, the ground rules are, shall we say, the standard model of physics, if you will, and in fantasy, it's whatever set of, call it a universal operating system, the author wants to put together. In the Recluse books, my operating system is the balance between order and chaos. I basically use a different operating system for each fantasy universe, but I make a great effort to be rigidly consistent with the operating system, whether it's science fiction or whether it's fantasy. But beyond that, I don't treat them any differently. The characters just have to work within the operating system.
Well, with that, let's talk more specifically about your novel, Haze. It came out in 2010, I believe. Maybe I'll let you synopsize it so you don't give away anything that you don't want to give away.
Well, it's set in the roughly 5,000 years in the future. You've got a Chinese federation ruling the world. What it used to be the United States is a client state, if you will, of China. And the main character is an American-born intelligence agent working for this Chinese federation. And in essence, there are, if you will, 2.5 storylines, although both the storylines concern the main character. One's in the present, and one's a flashback through the past. And he's basically tasked with investigating a planet, which is called Haze, because none of the Chinese Federation's surveillance gear will penetrate the armada of anti-spy devices that circle this planet. And he is one of several teams plunked onto this planet to try and discover what's behind it all. That's the setup.
And it was a very interesting setup, and you kind of mentioned the structure there. I did find it intriguing, the alternating between the flashbacks and the present. And what was the genesis of the novel? What was the seed that led to the development of the novel? What made you think of this story?
You know, I honestly can't tell you, except part of it was the idea of what would happen if China continued on its present course and American politics continued on their present course. The Chinese have always tended toward imperial states of one sort or another, and they've tended to be both ruthless and bureaucratic simultaneously. And that, I guess, was the background that I created. And they pretty much co-opted every culture that's tried to co-opt them. That was the background. And of course, somebody is going to want to get out from underneath this, and that's the genesis of the people on Dubiety or Hayes.
Often when we're talking about science fiction, there's the two big questions that start a story off, what if, and if this goes on. So this one is a bit more of the if this goes on than the what if, or a mixture.
I'm a big believer in the what if.
That's a very long time in the future, 5,000 years. Did you feel that you captured the changes that you'd have in technology and all that sort of thing over that amount of time?
I think one of the things that people tend to forget, and a lot of people would say, well, why isn't it more fantastic? Well, people forget how fantastic things are right now. For example, we now communicate as fast as it is possible to communicate on a planet. We have essentially pretty much instantaneous communication, if we have the technology, but the ability is there, anywhere on the planet. We can get to any place on the planet in a matter of hours. There's not that much difference in terms of the culture and the society between, even if we had matter transporters, between instantly and a few hours. There's a huge difference between a few hours and weeks or months, as was once the historical case. And you can take you can analogize all of these things to, there's only so much further ahead you can go with technology. You can't talk any faster than instantaneously. And it takes a certain amount of energy, no matter what you want to do, to create things. Theoretically, we could, I suppose, put together food replicators that could create anything from constituent elements. But the technology and the energy required, well, with that, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to simply go to natural foods. So I don't think you're going to see changes in those things. So basically, yes, the society I postulated is much further ahead. I did suspect that the Chinese, and I did this in 2010 before this became well known, that the Chinese would find a way to, shall we say, co-opt the internet and pretty much move into a world spy state. And I also postulated that certain parts of the world would not be at that point inhabitable for various reasons.
I also wondered if what you were going for there was that it is a very static society. The Federation is very static and doesn't seem likely to evolve very quickly, if at all, which I suppose is also a feature of Chinese imperial state over the centuries.
Well, it's not only Chinese imperial states, but I mean, if you go back to ancient Egypt, which was in essence a water empire, mm-hmm. that actually is the longest period of maintaining a similar government structure in human history that we know of. It's actually outlasted the Chinese. I mean, yes, there are pharaohs, and you have the first dynasty and the second, all of these various dynasties, but basically governmental structure in Egypt stayed pretty much the same from like 4500 BC through the time of when the Romans finally conquered it. And even into Ptolemaic Egypt, it was somewhat similar.
Which is pretty much the same time frame you're talking about in the book, Into the Future.
Yeah.
Is that the way that this idea came to you? Is we've talked about Hayes, but what's kind of more generally, how do ideas come to you? I know it's the old story, where do you get your ideas? But it's a valid question that people like to hear the answer to. How do stories tend to come to you?
Sometimes it's just thinking about things, but probably a lot of it comes to the fact that I still study a huge amount of both history, technology. My wife laughs. She says that every time the mailman comes to our house, he heaves a sigh of relief because the amount of periodicals we take, and I admit that I like print periodicals because I can browse them at odd places and odd times, but I think I take 3 archaeology magazines, a couple of history magazines, a lot of technology magazines, economic magazines, and of course my wife takes all sorts of music periodicals. And I read them all. And I'm not sure I could say, oh gee, this story came from this particular point.
So it's sort of keeping the mind fed so that it continually percolates up ideas.
Well, I think the best resource that an author can have is a well-educated subconscious. We don't remember all of it consciously. You can maybe call it up, but you don't remember everything that you read. But I'm convinced that your subconscious or your latent memory, if you will, remembers most of it. And the more stuff you pile in there, the more likely you are, at least I believe so, to come up with good ideas.
Do you read a lot of other fiction, or do you mostly read nonfiction?
At one point, when I was, even before I started writing, I was probably reading 400 to 600 science fiction books a year. Right now, it's more like 40 to 50. Most of my reading is nonfiction now. I'm fortunate. I can read very quickly, and I can retain most of what I read, which I find is a tremendous advantage.
Well, I basically read Hayes in half a day, so I'm fairly fast when I put my mind to it.
That's fast.
But I don't read that many books, and I wish I did, but I don't. So with that initial idea in mind for any book, how do you go about shaping the world? Do you like start with characters? Do you set out a plot and then the characters develop, or how does the process work for you?
Well, it varies a little bit from book to book, but in general, I tend to start with the world, the structure of the society, the religion, the environment, those factors, because they shape an awful lot of what you can do with a book. Resources are a factor. How do you get them? Where are they? Who controls them? Geography. And obviously social and religious or belief structures. And those shape people, and people shape government. And I come up with those sorts of governments. I mean, it's not monolithic. When you look at the Recluse series, which is my biggest series, I mean, it's across over 2,000 years, and in the course of the 20-plus volumes, there are stories set on 5 different continents and more than 20 countries. And the government systems that I have in those countries vary tremendously. I mean, there are military matriarchies, trading councils, hereditary monarchies, various other structures, an imperial structure in one particular case, based a lot on their past history and also the cultures and the geographies there. I don't know, I'm probably wandering off your question, but...
No, not really. So you write all of this down before you start? Do you take copious notes and outline and do a detailed synopsis, or how does that work for you?
I don't do synopses. I do have a set of notes. When I'm doing a fantasy, I have a rather large scale, rather large and rather messy scale map of the countries and the world that I'm working in. I'm very big on scale maps because when I was younger, I got really irritated at writers who, over the course of a book, had the same journey take quite varying times without any changes in the climate or the cargo or what have you. So I try and be fairly accurate about that. I try and set up a structure that fits and then work within it.
So the actual plot, how detailed do you set that out before you begin, or does a lot of that happen as you write?
The overall plot arc, I know pretty much the beginning and the ending. How I get there is something that I have to work out as long as I go along, because you've got to work. I mean, there are times when I have gotten to a point in a book and I've thought, well, I thought this character was going to do that, but the way I've written this character, he or she is not going to act that way. And so I'll have to figure out another way for that character to get to that end, given their character.
Well, and speaking of characters, how do they arrive on the scene? How do you decide what characters you need, and then how do you go about bringing them to life?
A lot of that depends. I mean, it's chicken and the egg thing. A lot of that depends on the structure and what you're trying to do. In the first book of the Reckless Saga, I was thinking about Laris in terms of a very bright, but almost Asperger's-like, clueless young man who was good-hearted. And the reason why it was written in the first person, past tense, rather than the third person, is if I'd written it in the third person, Laris would have come off as the most obnoxious, self-centered young man you could possibly imagine. He wasn't. He was good-hearted, essentially clueless, and dense about a lot of things. But you wouldn't be able to see that from the outside. So that's one of the ways where the character defines the structure. Mm-hmm. In other cases, I mean, if you go to Adiamante, which is one of my science fiction novels, it was actually taken from life, in a way. An acquaintance of ours in his, shall we say, late middle age, suddenly lost his wife to a fast-moving form of cancer. And I started thinking about what would that be like? And then I put it in a science fiction setting. And so it's really a science fiction novel about a man in either late middle age or early old age who's had a certain amount of power in the past and is called on to deal with a very difficult situation because of that expertise. And how he deals with it is intertwined with, call it, his grief and his understanding of where he's been. So that's another way of bringing a character into a story. Soprano Sorceress, or the Spellsong Cycle, is a music fantasy set in what I would call a Germanic misogynistic society. And I came up with that particular idea because I was thinking about how well today singers are trained, because obviously my wife is a singer and trains them. And what would happen if you had a society governed by song magic? And a lot of things fell into place there, because one of the things I realized was, even if you had song magic, you're not going to have very many sorcerers or sorceresses. And the reason for this is something that a confluence of two events that everybody overlooks. First, to really train somebody well as a singer, you really have to train them young. I mean, basically, after puberty and before 30. Second, that's the most self-centered time in human existence. And if you are going to give somebody the power that could kill you, you're going to be very careful about who you train. Then you add to this an outside sorceress from our world who's got all those abilities in a misogynistic society, well, I thought it would make for an interesting conflict. And it did.
So it sounds like a lot of your stories actually arise because of the interplay of the character with the world that you've created.
Exactly. But I mean, that's life. Everything we do is created by the interplay of the character with society and what goes on.
Do you like a detailed character sketch? And everybody does this differently, that's why I ask. Like a detailed character sketch and, you know, all these details about their past life, or does it arise more organically as you write?
I think more I have a feel for the character to begin with, of, call it, a sense of who he or she is. Then I fill in some of the details, and then we start filling in the society, the conflicts, and it goes from there.
A lot of writers, and it's happened to me, a character that you put in simply because you need, for example, someone in place to give a view on something that you need the readers to know is happening, and your main character is elsewhere, then turns into a more major character than you anticipated. Does that sort of thing happen to you?
I can't say that it happens in that fashion, although there have been some characters that were minor characters in one book that I thought, I really want to find out more about this character. And so I wrote a book about them.
And usually if you want to find out more about the character, the reader wants to find out more about the character too, so that works out.
Yeah.
What's your actual writing process look like? Do you write by hand? Do you write on a computer? Do you write in a typewriter? Do you write in an office or in a coffee shop? How does that work for you?
Okay, one, I do not write longhand. I'm left-handed. I probably wasn't trained properly in penmanship, and I get writer's cramp after 200 words writing longhand. Mm-hmm. I started writing on a typewriter when I was 15 years old, just for school and what have you. I moved to computers as soon as computers had enough memory to accommodate my style of writing, and I write on a computer. In terms of schedule, my wife laughs when people ask, do I have time for writing? She just says, he writes anytime he can get it, which is pretty much all the time. But to be fair about this, I don't neglect her, because when I proposed to her, I said, well, you know, I'll need time to write. And her reaction was really simple. She just started laughing. And when she finished laughing, she said, you are going to have more time to write than you have ever had in your life. And she was right. Because basically, she's a classically trained lyric soprano who's done some work in opera, but she basically runs the university opera program and the voice program, and her schedule is 9 to 10 in the morning until 7 to 11 at night, depending on the time of year. She was right. I have plenty of time to write.
Well, and you're quite prolific. You've done as many as 2 or 3 books a year, haven't you?
I've averaged 2.5 books a year for the last 20-plus years.
So that makes me wonder what your revision process looks like. Do you have a very clean manuscript when it's finished? Do you have to go back and do a lot of rewriting? Do you use beta readers? How does that work for you?
Actually, according to my editors, I turn a very clean manuscript. I write a lot, but I revise continuously as I'm writing, and then I generally revise again after I've finished with the first draft of the manuscript, which is a little misleading, because there are probably some parts of that manuscript I've rewritten a dozen times before I finally finish it. Revisions for me are both fun and by far the easiest part of the process. As far as editorial revisions, I've had the same process with both of my editors, and I've only had 2 editors in the entire time I've been in the field. One was David Hartwell, who was my editor for my first book until his death a couple of years ago. And the second is my current editor, Jen Gunnels, who was David's assistant, and I've been working for her about a year and a half before David died. And she and I worked together well, so I just stayed with her. But in terms of dealing with the editors, I've always had a very simple formula. Find anything you can that's wrong with the manuscript. Tell me what it is. Don't tell me how to fix it. Just tell me what the problem is. If I can't fix it, then we'll talk. In 40 years, I've never had to have the second conversation.
Mm-hmm. And you're at 70-some books at this point, aren't you?
73 published, 3 more that will be published in the next year and a half.
What kind of research do you have to do? There's a lot of interesting detail about economics and all that sort of thing in all of your books and in the society. Do you do a lot of research along the way?
Yes and no. I do a lot of research, but a lot of the research I've done in advance, just simply by all the things that I read. Every once in a while, I'll have to look up something to make sure I've remembered it or I've gotten the details correct. But it's been said that all men are collectors. I don't know if this is true, but an awful lot of men I know collect things. I don't. What I collect is information. I love information. I love learning about things. And I think I probably always will. And as an author, it serves me very well.
One of the things about Hayes that struck me was that, you know, we talk about science fiction as a literature of ideas, and it seemed to me that one of the things you're doing in Hayes was offering different views of how society might work and bouncing these off of each other. Mm-hmm. There were things like freedom and individual responsibility and empire and what happens when societies of different technological abilities clash. Is that kind of a feature of your work?
I'm not sure my work would exist without that. I'm always bouncing various ideas of how people respond to duty, responsibility, political structures, beliefs. I guess in a lot of ways, that's really what I do.
Well, certainly that in Hayes, comes through quite a lot with the difference between the Federation and the society on
Dabaiety.
Hayes is easier to remember than Dabaiety, I admit.
Well, that's probably true. One thing I would say that the conflict that you're talking about is a little stronger in my science fiction. It's a little more subterranean, a little deep, and a little quieter in the fantasy, but it's there.
What does it break down for you between science fiction and fantasy right now in numbers of books?
We're talking like 29 with the ones I've turned in, 29 science fiction novels, so that makes 44, I think it is. 45 fantasy novels. In recent years, it's been more than 2-to-1 fantasy to science fiction.
Do you find an overlap in your readership between the two, or do you find you have a science fiction readership and a fantasy readership?
Actually, I'd say I have 3 readerships. I have a science fiction readership, a fantasy readership, and a readership that does both.
Well, you have a large readership, so that's the important thing.
There are definitely more fantasy readers. But sometimes the science fiction readers get a little irritated and say, why don't you write more science fiction instead of that fantasy stuff?
I'm a reader of both, so it doesn't bother me either way. I like them both. I was also going to ask you, because you've written a number of series, and they are expanding, I was on a panel recently at CanCon in Ottawa and with Kevin Hearn and Julie Sharnada and... I can't remember the other one off the top of my head, but we were talking about series and the challenges of writing series. Do you find that continuity and keeping everything straight becomes difficult as a series expands in length?
It's difficult, but I'm not sure it becomes more difficult the way I do it. I think it would be very difficult done the way the Wheel of Time was done, but most of my series are not exactly series in what one would consider the traditional thing. And what I mean by that is, the Recluse series is now something like 22 books. But with one exception, there are no more than two books and sometimes only one book about one character. In a lot of ways, the continuing factor in Recluse is the world and the cultures, not the characters. Same thing is true of the imager portfolio. There's in essence a trilogy followed by a five-book one about a different character and then two-book series. Spellsong Cycle, three about one character, two about another character. And the Korean Chronicles, that was 3, 3, and 2. So I have to keep the world consistent, but I don't have quite as much to do with keeping the characters consistent over a long arc.
Do you have to go back and reread books when you go back into a series after you've written something else?
A little bit, but not a huge amount. Once I get back into a series, it seems like most of the main threads and the pieces come back to me. I often have to check up on little details, particularly if I've got a character that's consist a minor character that carries through the books. Usually with the major characters, I can remember, and I have notes on them.
Well, the name of this podcast is the World Shapers, and one of the things I'd like to ask all the guests is, do you hope that your fictional worlds help shape the real world in some fashion? What impact, if any, would you like your fiction to have on the real world, or at least on your readers within the real world?
That's one of the reasons why I write, because we tend to get bogged down in the real world, and I speak from almost 20 years in national U.S. politics. When you bring up a problem in the context of the real world, people get hung up with their tribe, they get hung up with everything around them. When you take that same problem and you put it in a fictional world or a fantasy world or a future world, people can look at the problem far more objectively and think, oh, there might be another way to deal with this. I had a rather hard lesson with this very earlier in my career. With Bruce Levinson, we wrote a book called The Green Progression, and it actually got a review from the Washington Times that said it was one of the best views of contemporary politics written. It's also one of the worst-selling books that Tor ever published. And to me, that just proved the point. People really don't want to look hard and fast at the current political structure, at their beliefs and how they affect the current political structure. They're locked into it by their neighbors, their culture, their friends. You take the same problem and you put it in a fictional world, they're much more open-minded about it. And I hope somehow that some of what I do in that sense will help people look at these problems in a different light.
Have you had any feedback from readers to that effect?
I have. I've had more than a few people say that they wish I'd either stayed in politics or gotten back into it. But no.
Well, and the other big question that I like to ask is very basic, and that is simply, why do you think any of us write, and why in particular, what do you think is the appeal of writing within the science fiction and fantasy genres for you and for anyone?
I don't know that I can speak to anybody else. I write because I have to write. I wouldn't be complete without writing. And that's very selfish, but I try and leaven that with hopefully entertaining people, making them think, and giving them a feeling. One of the things I try and leave all readers with in any of my books is at least a shred of hope, if not more.
There's certainly a lot of fiction out there that seems to go the other way.
Yeah, and some of it's very well written, but that's just not my cup of tea. I think that, especially now, there's way too much gloom, doom, and despair, and a lot of it is justified, but in the fictional world, I just like to give people shreds of hope, and sometimes more.
You've talked about, in at least one interview I read, about how important telling a good story is. What do you think the appeal is of story to people? Why are we so interested in stories?
because we are, human beings are anecdotal. We have trouble with statistics. We're innately number hampered. And we don't really like facts. Stories are what we think about. Stories are what influence us. I can't tell you why, but I know it's so. And stories are what motivate us. And I'd like to be one of those doing some of the motivating.
So what are you working on now?
I just turned in, and I'm going to do this first, I just turned in a very far future hard science fiction, or actually it's a hard science fantasy novel, entitled Quantum Shadows. The subtitle is 45 Ways of Looking at a Raven. And that's because every one of the 45 chapters is prefaced by a couplet to the raven, who is one of the main characters. So that's what just happened.
I was going to say 45 Ways of Looking at a Raven sounds like a poetry book title.
Well, that's why it's a subtitle. That's why Quantum Shadows is the novel title. But there are only 45 couplets. And out of 93,000 words, I think readers can deal with 45 couplets.
One would hope.
And then currently I've gone back. I am writing another recluse book. This one is, well, it's about a new character that nobody's seen, so I don't want to say much about it because I've only written about 65,000 words. And that means I got another 120,000 to go.
What will be the very next thing that's published?
Next thing that will be published is the last book in the Imager portfolio. That's Endgames, and it'll be out, I think it's February 5th next year. After that, next August, will be The Magefire War, which is the third book about Belter on the Recluse Saga. And then after that will be Quantum Shadows.
And all published by Tor.
Right. As a matter of fact, my first two books were published by other publishers, but all of my books are now under Tor and have been for 30-some years.
Well, as you said, you've only ever worked with two editors, so... It's a lot of authors I talk to, once they've found an editor, if the editor stays at the publishing house, they're very loyal to that editor if they find an editor they can work with. Certainly, my editor is Sheila Gilbert at Daw, and talking to Tanya Huff, and she says if Sheila retires, then Tanya may quit writing because she loves her editor. And it sounds like you've had good experience with your editors, too.
Yeah, I can't tell you how fortunate I am that Jen and I get along, and she pretty much followed in a lot of ways the example set by David. But I also realized something rather amusing about the whole thing. Most people don't know that David, although he's been a fixture in science fiction for years, most people outside of the inside don't realize that he also had a PhD in comparative medieval literature. And what's interesting is that Jen has a PhD in theater history. So I may be one of the few novelists who's been edited by academic PhDs who are also very strong in science fiction and fantasy.
Well, actually, both of those PhDs sound like they could play into some of your fiction with the performance and of course, well, the medieval literature as well.
But, I mean, I think it has made it a lot easier for me dealing with them, because I tend to, let's put it this way, there is a lot of subterranean depth in what I write, and it's helpful to have editors who can recognize it.
And where can people find you online?
I don't do Facebook or Instagram, but I have a website, and it's very simple. It's L. E. Modisett Jr., all the letters run together with no punctuation, .com.
Do you miss the social media?
No. Social media is a time sink, and frankly, I'd rather spend the time writing.
I'm on it, and I often think I maybe would like to get off of it. I may do that at some point. Well, thank you so much for being on The World Shapers, Lee. I really appreciate it. It's been a very interesting conversation.
I really appreciate your having me on here, and I wish you well with future interviews and other authors.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That brings us to the end of another episode of The World Shapers. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Lee Montesit Jr. Just a reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. It's also on Twitter at The World Shapers, and it's on Facebook. Just look up The World Shapers. You can find me, your host, Edward Willett, online at edwardwillett.com. Don't forget, there are two T's on Willett, two L's and two T's. You can also find me on Facebook at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett, and you can find me on Twitter at ewillett. I hope you'll come back for future episodes of The World Shapers. Many great guests to come. I'm still lining them up, and I'm very excited about many of those I'll be talking to, people like Tad Williams, Kevin Hearn, Tosca Lee, Kim Harrison, Peter V. Brett, David Brin will be coming up for the next episode after this one. Just a very exciting lineup, and many more exciting possibilities down the road. So please do come back and join me again. I will be here, and I hope you will be too, as we continue to explore the creative process behind the science fiction and fantasy novels that we have all enjoyed so much over the years. That's it for this time. Bye for now.